You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There you go. And that's probably the last time we'll do it for the next 2 hours, because we always forget.
The three amigos.
You can find everything about the program. You can find all the archives, contact information. If you've got sponsorship ideas or show ideas, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We are not going to fool around this afternoon.
No, we're going to get with it.
Yeah, because today we're talking about collectivism. And if you have been listening to the show for, I didn't go back and look, but I don't think we've done a program on collectivism for a very long time. And it's a topic really worth studying, especially since we get so hung up in left and right and conservative and liberal and blah, blah, blah. It's worth it to look at collectivism versus individualism. That's the other option there. So we are chatting today with G. Edward Griffin. And I believe we're all situated and he's on the line. I know this takes away everybody's fun because usually there's some kind of weird drama at the beginning. Are you with us?
Oh, I'm right with you all the way.
See, that just takes all the fun out of it.
I can hardly wait for this weird drama, though.
There's usually,
it's coming.
The phone doesn't work, or Bill's got his microphone on backwards, or I don't know, there's something. Today's like foolproof. That's a good sign. So you have been, when did you write your first book? I didn't know.
Oh, my gosh. I guess my first book was back in, I don't know. I have to look it up. It's back in the 60s sometime.
Yeah, it's been a long... you've had a really long career. Your name should be familiar to pretty much everybody. I posted online, your collectivism. It's actually a brochure. It could be printed as a brochure. So that's what people have access to, and everything else you'll have to tell them.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I share your evaluation of the word collectivism, how important it is, and it sounds so dull, doesn't it? Like,
it actually kind of sounds like, you know, we're all going to go buy Sprouts and wear sackcloth. I mean,
let's talk about sex and violence or something. What's this collectivism stuff?
Yeah, it almost kind of waxes on that co-op thing, It sort of does.
Well, it originates with the hippies. Yeah. They had it down at the beginning, you know.
Hey, and Bill was perusing your site and learned the origins of the peace symbol last night.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about that before we let you go. I found it really interesting where the whole peace symbol originally came from. I think most people probably don't have a clue. We'll get to that.
Yeah, I didn't have a clue either. I remember this goes back to the 70s. Everything goes way, way back with me. But I remember when a guy who is an assistant, I can't think of his name, Ralph. I'll think of it in a minute. He worked for Dr. John Richardson, who is a friend of mine that had a practice up in San Francisco area. And anyway, he was a great researcher. He had a collection of weird books, I thought. Of course, now that's my collection. But,
sounds like all of us.
He produced this huge book. It was on symbols, you know, ancient symbols and occult symbols. It was very scholarly work. And he showed me this peace symbol. It was the origin of it. And he said, this is, as you can see, it's got the satanic origin in it, all the things we were talking about in this thing. And I really had trouble with it because I didn't want to believe that so many people would be using a symbol that had these nefarious origins. But boy, I checked into it, I looked in some other references, and sure enough, it was true. So, it's a shocker to me. It was then, at least.
Yeah, Bill's reading me some of it, and it's like, yikes. Yeah. You have a lot of stuff on your website, and it's interesting because the little bio I posted about you says, G. Edward Griffin is a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit. Listed in Who's Who in America, he's well known because his talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that everyone can understand. He's dealt with such diverse topics as archaeology and ancient earth history, the Federal Reserve System, with the creature from Jekyll Island that I think probably a lot of our listeners would be familiar with, and international banking, terrorism, but you wind up getting pigeonholed sometimes. With the same thing I think we all get brushed with, you're just a conspiracy guy.
Yeah. Well, that's what Wikipedia doesn't like me.
No, I noticed that.
I think the thing that triggered it, I was okay until they discovered that I was sort of an alternative health guy. I didn't really get too enthusiastic about pharmaceutical drugs and man-made drugs for the treatment of diseases. I thought that nature had a better answer. And since when I took that tack, and especially with my book that was published in 1974, I do remember the date on that one. It was called World Without Cancer, the story of vitamin B17. Well, then they came unglued. And from that, when they discovered that, they started the first line in my biography on Wikipedia is, G. Edward Griffin, well-known conspiracy theorist,
I read that, and I was like, that won't be the biography I'll be using. I'll need to find another one.
Yeah, and of course, and I use the word repeatedly throughout, and this is a very interesting and aggravating topic to me, of course, because, you know, you don't like to have people think of you as some kind of a tinfoil hat person. That's what that phrase is supposed to trigger.
Right.
And I have no control over it. And it was very interesting because I got a letter from a lady who was actually one of the administrators and editors at Wikipedia. And she said, you don't know me, and you may not know this, but in the back room here at Wikipedia, there is a war going on over you. I said, what? Over me?
Right on.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, yeah, to make a long story short, there were some editors there, you know, just very sincere, dedicated people, and they came across my biography, and they said, well, here's another one of those wackos, and they started to check out what I'd read, and they said, well, no, this isn't wacko at all. This is good stuff. It's backed by science, and they started to challenge it. Well, that started a war in the back room of Wikipedia. I guess it still goes on because the word or the phrase conspiracy theorist is still there.
Yeah,
but
it was there
anyway.
Yesterday.
Yeah, if you'll notice in Wikipedia, and that's not our topic today, but if you notice, anybody in the alternative health field is described as a wacko. So that should be a sign right away, a clue that there's something not right going on at Wikipedia.
Yeah. Well, and then you threw down and you had another conference in Arizona refuting, what was it, global warming?
Oh, yeah, oh, global warming, inconvenient lie.
An inconvenient lie, yeah.
Inconvenient lie.
It was a great title.
Sort of a subtle thing, you know, a subtle title.
What was it about?
Well, it was, let me think.
Yeah, so you've weighed in on a lot of things that they're going to love to hate. So we should give people your website is freedomforceinternational.org. It's spelled all spelled out. freedomforceinternational.org. And I'll tell you what, that is a wealth of information. You've got some really good video on there and just a ton of research. So very much appreciate that. And we have that posted, but in case I forget to give it out. So let's see, Bob, what do you think? Should we take a really swift break so we don't wind up behind the whole time?
And sounds like a novel idea.
Yeah, I know. We never do that. And then we will launch into collectivism with our friend G. Edward Griffin. Be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Damn, Bob, I told you not to bring up my past.
They're an honor of our peace symbol. Good one. Mr. Griffin, you have to just forgive us. We can't help ourselves.
Well, that's okay. I'm not an old hippie. I wish I were. I think the hippies had a lot of fun, but I missed all that.
So did they, really. Most of them don't remember much.
Yeah, I was working hard, and they were having fun. I was jealous.
Yeah, it was chaos, I think. It looks like chaos anyway.
Yeah, well, that's why you're writing books, and I'm talking to you about them.
I was a kid. What do I know? Oh, funny. All right, so where would you like to start with collectivism?
Start with collectivism, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, where do you start with that? I guess I'll just have to tell you a little bit about my story of why it's so important to me now and now to a lot of people. You know, I've been in this battle for, let's just call it what I consider it to be a battle for freedom, since about 1960s when I first discovered that we had a problem in the world, and particularly here in America. I was raised like most people, especially at my age. I was raised, you know, America was all apple pie and motherhood and patriotism and all of the good things. And I still have that feeling and that great feeling of love for my country and my countrymen. But I began to be aware that something was wrong among the leadership level, that I began to suspect that our leaders were more like con artists than real statesmen and, you know, real Americans. I began to realize that they represented ideas which were different from what our founding fathers had. And I was never much of a student. You know, to me, going to school was punishment for being young. And I had to learn. I had to read books, and I hated it. I wanted to just have fun. And so when I came out of school, it's good that I had been such a lackluster student. I got grades were okay, probably B's and B pluses and so forth. But I, you know, mostly I took all the easy courses I could, so I didn't have to work too hard. All of that, and you know, I really studied girls more than anything. And so I was lucky when I came out of all that that I hadn't really been a student because I didn't have an awful lot to unlearn. But I did. I did know enough to realize that there was something fishy going on at the highest levels, and it seemed like it was contrary to the American tradition. So it's kind of triggered my curiosity, and, well, I went back too far, you know, on this. Let's fast forward to the realization that all of the problems that I could see in the world today were based not on the fact that there were evil men in positions of office, but because of what these men believed. It was something they believed in, and to them it really wasn't evil. Maybe in some cases it was. Here you get psychopaths in office, but I realized that a lot of these evil men that people were talking about being evil really thought of themselves as being high on the high road. They had a goal that was different than mine, and I became curious about what was this goal. And so I found out, and I began to read all of the works of the great leaders of the totalitarian movements of our age. I became interested in Marx. Of course, everybody had to read a little bit about Marx, but I got really into it. And, you know, Lenin and Khrushchev and all of them. In fact, I remember when I was in Los Angeles and working for a large insurance company, I was climbing that corporate ladder and all of that. But I remember I went down to the communist bookstore in Los Angeles. It was called the People's Bookshop. Everything was the people this, the people that, and so forth. It was down in Larchmont Street. And I met the comrades down there, and they kind of took a liking to me. They thought they were going to recruit me into the party. You know, I was a little different than that. They were more on the hippie side that we were talking about before, but not all of them. And they had some very normal people there and some very high-level people, but here I came in as a young corporate type. You know, I had a suit on and a narrow tie and had the sideburns. You know, I had to wear them in those days. And they thought, here's a guy interested. So they tried to recruit me, and they invited me to what they call their study groups, who were really the wide end of the funnel to bring you into the party. So I went to their study groups, and I, you know, discussed these things. I got all the books from from Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, and I read Karl Marx, you know, Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto and all that.
You got them all. Like,
wow.
Oh, yeah, all of them. You should see my library. In fact, when I've got a pretty good library, and I started, unfortunately, with some of that crap. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. But I read them all, you know, and I had to realize that there was an underlying appeal if you weren't too critical. You know, the slogans are great. You know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. What's wrong with that? You know, isn't that the basis of charity? And, you know, workers of the world unite against the forces of fascism, racism, and war, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And if you just listen to the slogans, you got to sign up. You just have to go. Anyway, so I read all that stuff, and I think probably I got to know more of it than the guys that were teaching the class because they were a little bit shallow on that stuff. But then I got interested in what I thought was, initially I thought it was the opposite of communism, and that was Nazism and fascism. So, you know, naturally you go to the works of all the great fascists. And Adolf Hitler was, of course, the most notable one. You read his Mein Kampf. And then, you know, later on you read the little red book from Mao Zedong. And so I was reading all this stuff. And this library of mine, I'd mentioned it before, my little kids would come along and I'd see them looking at my library. And I realized I had a lot of books that really I didn't believe in. So I had to point out to the kids, I said, now that shelf down there, those are the bad guys down there. And the ones up here, these are the good guys. And the kids came in, and they were little kids. And they said, oh, is this a bad guy book or a good guy book? Well, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, you know, if you're a little kid. So here I go wandering again, but this is my background. So you asked for it. This is what's
That's okay.
Out.
That's what we do.
Yeah, that's what we do when we talk about ourselves, a terrible thing. Well, anyway, to cut to the chase, after I got through all of this stuff, it subconsciously began to be aware that there was a commonality to it all. And I started to make a list of the things that were the same. And after this is a 2 or 3 year project on my part. It wasn't something I just sat down and decided I was going to do. It just sort of happened in my spare time. And at the end of this 2 or 3 years, I had this list, and I thought, my gosh, there is no difference between them except the names of the authors. There were commonalities to all of these things, and that, when I got it all together, is what I realized was what the old writers called collectivism. And that I discovered that all of these things like communism, socialism, fascism, Nazism, left-wingism, liberalism, you know, New Dealism, all these words come into our vocabulary throughout history. But if you peel off the label and you look underneath, they are all the same. And some of the more scholarly authors of 100 years ago referred to that as collectivism. And so I started to go to the encyclopedia. We didn't have the internet in those days. You actually had to go down to a thing called the library. It was a big building, and they had books in it.
And that was our high school excuse for leaving the house. Are you kidding?
Yeah, good excuse to bug it out. But I never went to a library in my life unless I had an exam coming up, you know. And all of a sudden, I found myself could hardly wait to get back into the library and to look up these things. And I was embarrassed to tell my friends that I was doing this, but nevertheless, that was what was going on. And so I started to read, and I found out that there was an old literature that goes back, 100 years now. It was only 70 years when I started this, or 60 years now. So many more years have been added to it. But in our modern world, we've forgotten the word collectivism, and we've forgotten that collectivism has a constructive opposite to it, and it's called individualism. So finally, okay, that's the background, how I discovered these words and began to find the old books that had them in it. And I found out that the so-called bad guys, the Adolf Hitlers and the Khrushchevs and the Stalins and the Lenins and, you know, all of these people, they did use that word, by the way. They did, even though they're more in modern times. They knew exactly what it was. And then I got into the the think tanks in America, the Carnegie Endowment Fund for International Peace and the Ford Foundation, and I found that they had major projects back 50, 60, 70 years ago, and they used the word collectivism with great precision. They knew exactly what it meant, and they said, we must create collectivism. We must create an American appreciation for collectivism. We must teach collectivism in the schools. They used this word over and over again. I remember I read them years ago, and I didn't know what it meant. Now I had a little better understanding. They said, we must convince the students that collectivism is the wave of the future. It was one of the phrases that kept showing up. And we must control education in America so that students come out at the other end with a loyalty and a love for collectivism, and they must get rid of this thing called individualism, which served its purpose in history, but now it is a thing of the past. This is the kind of thing that I kept running across. Well, okay, you can be sure I got very interested at this point in finding out what is collectivism, what is individualism. So all of that is background. Now we come to the real thing, with what is it? This commonality to all of the socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, and so forth. Well, I made a list of ideas that I found common to them all. And there were many, but there were actually about eight or seven, I guess, that kept, they were really at the top of the list. And so I tried to codify them. I tried to narrow it down to, like, thesis sentences, you know, condensed, so that the essence would be there. All the fat would be stripped away, but the muscle would be there and the bones would be there. And I came up with the eight things that now are in what we call the creed of freedom in Freedom Force. It's the things that individualists believe. And what that all is about is that all of the great debates, the so-called political debates of our time, when people have these heated disagreements over we should do this or we should do that, I found out that you can, if you strip off the words, it is a debate between the ethics of collectivism versus the ethics of individualism. All of them in the Western world. Now, you get in other parts of the world and you have theology, you know, theocracies. People say, well, a government should be based on religion. It should be based on our concept of God. And that's why many of the pilgrims escaped Europe. They came to America to get away from that. And right now we see that concept in many parts of the Middle East and so forth. So there are parts of the world that still the debate is over, you know, theocracy, the role of religion and the marriage of religion and the state. But in the Western world, it's over ideology other than that, and that is all of it is in this debate between collectivism and individualism. Now, one more preface, and that is that I discovered that most, if not, well, almost all of the people in both camps are more in agreement than they realize. Most of them, all of them, I like to say, really want the same thing. They want good things in their minds. They want peace, prosperity. They want health. They want work. They want health. Yeah, I said health, but they want education. You know, all of the good things, they want them. Where they differ is how to get them, and that is the core of the whole. One of the core of the whole thing between collectivism and individualism. The collectivists want to bring it about by force, and the individualists want to bring it about by persuasion and freedom of choice and that kind of thing. Now, that's one of the eight things. So having said that, now let's go to do you want me to continue with this, or do you want me to take a break?
No, let's continue with it, but let's take a quick break first.
Okay, so we don't thought I'd used up a lot of time.
No, no problem. That way we don't have to interrupt you right in mid-sentence.
Okay,
we will be right back. You're listening to G. Edward Griffin discuss collectivism versus individualism. So for all of you out there who feel like a square peg in a round hole, today's the day you feel totally normal. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I just got out my little red book the minute that you said goodbye.
Bob's hooked on the peace symbol.
We're going to burst his bubble later.
he's taking us back to the 60s. Well, I was born in 1961, so my entire education was shaped by all these people who were hippies. And I have to say, there were some church, like retreat type things, and they always wanted us to talk about, you know, how our parents oppressed us, and didn't we want to, you know, like break out and do bad things or whatever. And I was the oldest of five kids, and we were a really tight-knit family, so they always keyed on me. What's wrong with her? Because they wanted us to know, they wanted us to tell them what was wrong with our parents. You know, what were our parents doing to us? You know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I don't know. My parents aren't doing anything. They're just regular.
It's what I'm doing to them.
And it was like, oh, she's got really big problems. They'd say, you're repressing it. That was the first time I heard the word repressed. What a bunch of loons. And these were people who were, you know, my dad was big on individualism,
That was back in the Dr. Spock days.
Exactly. And they wanted us to, you know, all be part of this. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it was never my deal. And so I always was the bad seed. So thanks for legitimizing my childhood, Mr. Griffin.
Well, that's nice. You know, I think all kids have this feeling that they're being repressed and oppressed by their parents. And if their parents are doing a good job, they probably should feel that way at times, because at least I'm speaking for myself, because as a kid I had impulses to do a lot of things that would have been bad for me. It would have been bad for the family. It would have been bad for the community and everything.
But we all knew that was wrong. I mean, I wasn't going to tell somebody my parents were oppressing me because they wouldn't let me stay out till midnight when I was in the sixth grade. Yeah. I mean, that just makes me sound like an idiot.
Well, plus your parents had a lot of oppression tools that they had at their disposal, too, that kind of kept you in line.
Well, I don't know. It was just regular, you know. I mean, those of us who grew up in kind of regular households, the 60s guys, the collectivist guys who wanted us to look at the world and everything was about the world and all that kind of stuff, when we were being raised by people who, you know, were trying to help us become individuals, that was all very weird.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things that you don't think about when you're kids, and at least I got to keep changing it, that I never thought about when I was a kid. I think it was fairly normal in that regard. I know with our family, I used to take advantage of the fact that the kids got hungry several times a day, and they had to come together and sit around a table. And so I nailed them. That was the time to talk, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You can eat your food fast if you wish, but you can't leave the table.
Right. that was our house.
And so, well, why can't? Well, because we got to talk. Well, what are we going to talk about? Well, I don't know. Let's find something interesting to talk about. What do you want to talk about? And if they wanted to talk about the latest movie or something, it was fine. But they had to talk about something, and we tried to steer it a little bit into worthy topics. So anyway, they survived pretty well, actually. I'm very proud of my kids, and I'd like to think that requirement that we work together a little bit as a family, at least over meals, you know, I'd like to think and talk about things and other than, you know, what do you want to buy?
Right.
I think it had a good influence on them. So.
Well, that's as close to collective as I think most of us got.
Yeah.
Little did we know.
Yeah. You know, so we get back to this thing, collectivism. I'm looking at my list, and I've got number two here, which is called the supremacy of the individual. I sometimes think I should put that at the top.
Yeah, that's a biggie.
Because that's really the biggest one of them all. So do you want me to go into these, or should we?
Oh, no, definitely
do.
Yeah,
this is the creed of freedom, correct?
Yeah, the creed of freedom, yeah, number two. I'm going to put it up at number one for today, at least. The heading is the supremacy of the individual. And it's short, so I'll just read it. It says, I believe that one of the greatest threats to freedom is to allow any group, no matter its numeric superiority, to deny the rights of the minority. And that one of the primary functions of a just state is to protect each individual from the greed and passion of the majority. Okay, you know, that's there's the essence of it, because the word collective and collectivism and individualism says it all. The collectivists believe that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. You know, I was taught that in school, and when I heard it, I thought, that sounds pretty good, the greater good of the greater number. Isn't that good? Well, sure, it's good, but again, how do you achieve it? You know, the greater good of the greater number, I discovered, is to protect the rights of the individual. That's how you produce the greater good of the greater number. But if you sacrifice for the individual, for the group, you've made a big mistake, because, first of all, the group doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as a group. It's a word. It's an abstraction in the mind. You can't touch a group. You can't see a group. You can only see individuals. That's all that's real. A group is like a mathematical concept. It's in the mind. It's like the word forest. There's no such thing as a forest. There are trees, yeah. You can touch trees, you can see trees, but when you touch or see many of them, you say, oh, that's a forest. But the word forest is an abstraction. It doesn't really exist. It's
that's
a mathematical
true.
Thing. So when you say that the group, which is an abstraction, has rights that are superior to the individual, which is real, boy, what a terrible error you've made, because you've set in motion a situation where there are demagogues that come along, or politicians with great rhetoric, and they will convince you that they represent the group, and they will make decisions on behalf of the group, and the group is more important than the individual, so therefore you are an individual, and you can be sacrificed, if necessary, for the group. And boy, there's the beginning of all of the mischief right there. All of the great crimes, political crimes of history, at least in modern history, you know, the genocides, the wars, the false flag attacks, everything is that, well, it's pretty good because, you see, it was necessary for society. We have to sacrifice this person or these thousands of people or this million people. We have to sacrifice them for the greater good of the world or something like
that. When in reality, it was just the will of one individual.
It's the will of one individual or a small group of people.
Sure, or imposed on the group.
Yeah, and all they got to do is just say, well, we're doing this because it was for society, you know. We can't allow you to let your child go unvaccinated, even though you don't think it's right, even though the scientific evidence is that we're probably actually hurting the kid rather than helping him. In spite of everything, we say that vaccines are good, and therefore, if for the greater good of the greater number, your kid has to be vaccinated, come hell or high water, or else you go to prison, you see. That's collectivism in action.
Mm.
So, anyway, that's one example. So that's under the heading of the supremacy of the individual. It's a very important concept. You know, I speak of the group. You know, take a lynch mob, for example. Now, there's only one dissenting vote.
Typically.
So if you really go along with the greater good for the greater number, what's wrong with a lynch mob? What's wrong with this thing called democracy, you see? Oh, my gosh, this means you have to start thinking for a change. You can't just go along on slogans. You've got to dig a little bit deeper. And you find out, you come to this very interesting discussion that you sometimes hear about, the differences between a democracy and a republic. You know, what is that all about? Well, this is what it's all about. In a republic, a classical definition of the word republic, in today's world, the word republic doesn't mean anything.
No, that's a dirty word.
Yeah, we got Republic of China, you know, the Republic of Soviet Socialist Republic, you know, that called republic in today's world doesn't mean anything. But back in the days when our Constitution was written, the word republic had a very strong central meaning, and that was a constitutional form of the state in which the Constitution was written with statements that were designed specifically to protect the individual against the group.
Hmm.
Think about that. To protect that guy at the end of the rope. All right, he's only one, but this is not a mathematical concept, folks. This is a matter of individual rights versus group rights. You see, the individual, no matter what the crime, is entitled, according to the Constitution or bylaws or whatever you want to call your document, your statement of agreement that you've all agreed that this is the kind of a system we want to live under, the individual has a right to fair trial. And the fair trial is defined as A, B, C, D, and E, and so forth. It's all spelled out, things that the group cannot do against the individual. That's the whole nature of our Bill of Rights, is, you know, Congress shall pass no law restricting the right of freedom of speech. That means the group represented through Congress, even though the group elected the congressman and that's the representative of the majority, I don't care, the document says, the group shall not pass a law restricting the right of freedom of speech, peaceful assembly, the right to religion, and so forth. The group shall not do this. There's the difference between a republic and a democracy. It's a very important difference. And boy, when you're designing a state or society in which you want to live in, you better get it right, because you're going to, you know, if you don't have it right, you're going to live in slavery.
Well, it's interesting. I think people have gotten some decent education here since the election in the difference between a democracy and a republic when you start looking at the outcome of the vote. You know,
well,
half of the popular vote lives in 57 of the 3,100 counties in the U.S. So, yeah. So do you want to let 57 counties pick your next?
Yeah. Do we want to go to mob rule? Because
yeah,
that's what it'll be.
Does that really represent everyone? Is that really half? Kind of.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, because most people, as you say, don't get it. They think, oh, well, Hillary got the majority vote, so then she, winner takes all. See, that's the idea that people have now, not only in America, but around the world. If you can just win the election, you get it all, you know?
Well, I'm waiting to go all the way to the new philosophy where nobody loses, you know, because now everybody gets a trophy. So we'll have an election and they'll both be presidents.
Yeah, everybody gets a trophy. Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
participation. They participated.
Yeah, we had an election, but they were in it, so you know they can both run it.
Well, you see, when the Electoral College was created, it was understood that they did not want the populous states to dominate the less populated states. There again, the idea of protecting the individual or the minority against the majority. It was a very important concept.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, so many people don't understand the principle and the effect the Electoral College has on our elections. And, you know, now they're all screaming
in
a good way.
Yeah.
And they're all screaming, well, we need to get rid of it because it's not a true reflection of what people want. Well, if you want, the major population centers in the country to make all the rules, get rid of it, because that's exactly what will happen. We talk about no representation.
Yeah, and that would truly be the collectivist answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's collectivism, and let's face it, we live under collectivism. And my only bone of contention with some of my friends on this issue is they say, we live in this is a republic, not a democracy. And I say, no, wake up, smell the coffee. We live in a democracy, unfortunately. We used to live in a republic, but we've allowed it to be changed. Now we live under a democracy. Wake up. Now we got to do something about it, not just hold up the Constitution and say, I'm protected by the Constitution. No. That's not what's happening in the real world.
No, and I totally agree with you, because when it comes down to rules especially at the local level, you know, you have to have all these stupid meetings. Good Lord. You got to have all these stupid meetings with the, the bureaucrats. And everybody has to have a consensus, blah, blah, blah. Which means basically you agree with their predetermined outcome and they throw away your dissenting opinion. They scream consensus, run off and do what they want.
Yeah, that's right. It's all consensus. I hate to bring up the topic of global warming, but that was the event we had this last weekend, and the global warming theorists are always talking about, well, there's the census of
97% of all the scientists, blah, blah, blah.
And what a lie that is. But anyway, the idea that even if it were true, the idea that settles it, I mean, since when is the law of gravity, for example, or any scientific issue. Since when is that decided by how many people vote for it?
Right.
And really, yeah, when is science settled?
Well, the concept of science being settled means it's not going to be science.
Yeah.
It
means we have all the answers.
The only time they want to make a debate illegal, and that's what the global warming theorists are doing now, they're trying to pass laws so that you can't even discuss an opposing point of view anymore. They're going to call you a denier and put you in prison.
That's right.
Only time that an issue needs the force of law to defend it is when it's a lie. You know, the truth doesn't need that.
Right.
So, and there, well, I went.
Yeah, we get flashbacks to blasphemer. Yep. might as well just start burning them as heretics. Yeah. It's coming.
Get a box of rocks. Yeah. You need them.
Anyway, we'll. but we digress. Take one more quick break here, and we're going to come back with G. Edward Griffin. We're chatting about collectivism, in case you hadn't figured that out yet. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That ought to be a familiar song to my dad. In our individual paradise, yes, we had a lot of discussion about what to do.
Yeah, but there was a limited amount of voters.
Yeah, my dad had pretty much a monarchy going on there.
You know that song. If I think I heard the words correctly, "Don't tell me what to do."
Yeah, pretty much.
The line? Boy, that couldn't have been a better lead-in to the third principle in the Creed of Freedom, which is freedom of choice. You know, how do we determine to bring about this greater society, the better society? How do we bring it? Do we bring it to be by laws and the power of coercion, or do we bring it into being through education, the power of example, the good example, persuasion, and that kind of thing? Because you can't find a more clear distinction between collectivists and individualists than that. Both groups, they want the same thing, but the individualist says, okay, let's go persuade people to do it. We want to keep freedom of choice. But the collectivist says, nah, they won't do it. They won't do it. They'll make mistakes. So we have to force them. We have to pass laws. I have a friend, a good friend of mine. I jokingly call him the Kraut because he's of German origin, and very affectionately call him that, by the way. This is not an insult, everybody. Don't get excited.
we had neighbors that were Germans.
Don't start sending emails.
We always referred to him as the Nazi, but he liked it because he was a Nazi.
Back in the day, he was in the Hitler Youth.
Well, this guy is a Kraut, too. I mean, he got a lot of typical characteristics. That he's very strong-willed, like I am. I mean, I'm kind of a Kraut myself. But anyway, so he's classic because if he sees something he doesn't like there's a cigarette butt that he sees somebody throw onto the street. He says, there ought to be a law. There ought to be a law against it. No matter what it is, how serious or how harmless it is, there ought to be a law, because in his mind, people, if they're not forced to do it, they're not, a lot of them aren't going to do it. So we can't allow freedom of choice. Well, there's a clear-cut distinction between collectivism and individualism. If you don't allow people to make a mistake, if you say that the group can pass laws to force everyone, including yourself, yep, to do what the group thinks is best, then you've given up your liberty. You've lost it right then and there.
And they don't, and, you know, they don't see anything wrong with it when it seems to be going their way, and yet you gotta realize it. It could go sideways on you in a minute. So okay,
well, it always does. It's not that it could. It always does.
Yes, eventually, sure.
Eventually, yeah.
All right. So
and
the $64,000 question here is: are you going to come back with us after the break and do the other pillars or the other?
Oh, you know the answer to that.
All right. Hey, we got somebody who wants to hear about communitarianism as well. So I think we're talking about that now, but we'll touch on that when we come back.
We'll be right back with J. Edward Griffin, our hostage for the second hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.